Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program, South Africa's economy grows but barely at more than walking pace. I'll be in conversation with a senior representative from Stats SA. Vehicle recalls surge and dealership staff say they are taking heat from angry customers. Budget 2026 is under fire for risking a fossil fuel future just as the climate clock ticks down. And South Africa's retirement system is being reshaped. What the changes mean for your savings. It's Wednesday, the 11th of March. Now, new figures from Stats SA show the economy growing by 1.1% last year, up from 0.5% the year before, but I think still far below what is needed to tackle unemployment or meaningfully lift living standards. Growth is being driven largely by services, agriculture and consumer spending, while key sectors like manufacturing, construction and energy remain weak. That is a concern. Investment is also falling. Exports are under pressure. Let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Bogang Vumbukani Lebolesa, Chief Director of National Accounts at Stats SA. Bogang, a very warm welcome to you. That headline number, 1.1% growth, let me ask you bluntly, is that progress or are we still stuck effectively in economic stagnation?
Thanks, Jeremy. So that headline number for annuals is an indication that, yes, there is growth, but it's very slow. It's a positive that we can celebrate, but in terms of the challenges that we have in the economy, it is still very, very slow. But what may be important and interesting is that it is actually the highest in 3 years. So if you look at what happened prior or after COVID, prior to 2021, we had the highest growth in 2022. But after 2022, going forward to 2025, this is the largest that we have seen. It may be surprising to some people because I think the expectations were that it might be a little bit higher than what Stats SA provided, but the numbers directed to what we are seeing at this point in time. But perhaps having spoken about the annuals, it might be important to also just look at what happened quarterly. I know that sometimes the short-term frequency is often what we use as an indicator, but the long-term view also is somehow influenced by what we are seeing in the short-term front. You have correctly indicated that finance and the services have been in the fore. But on an annual basis, if you have a look at what happened within the industries, you saw that agriculture was one of the star performers with a double-digit growth rate. And I think this also wasn't a surprise because a lot of people expected the harvest that that we saw in 2025 to show in the numbers, and this is exactly what we are seeing. But on the short term, if we look at the short-term view of the industry, the agriculture industry specifically, we know that the country is still troubled by foot and mouth, and this is what we're seeing in the fourth quarter. It's very important because the numbers only show that what we're seeing as an improvement of 0.4% was primarily because of the increases in the activities in field crops as well as horticulture, not so much on the animal front.
So if that's the case, then if the growth is coming from agriculture and services, notwithstanding the problems with foot and mouth, do you think then that is a solid foundation or sign that the real economy is still struggling?
This is a sign that we are still struggling. I'll tell you why. The agriculture industry is one of the most vulnerable industries. We know that we can't predict what is going to happen. We know that it's still very reliant on the weather conditions. Just an example, we know that, you know, shocks like diseases can actually are very much risky, and they can actually lead to things changing drastically. So The long-term view of what we are seeing, well, even the double-digit figure that we are seeing, the agriculture, yes, it can be celebrated, but then it's too high a risk for us to say or conclude that perhaps this is going to help us, get out of the deep that we are in terms of economic challenges. In the short term, yes, we have problems related specifically to the diseases, but if there are cures and there are measures in place and initiatives that help us get out of the current situation, in the long run that will definitely benefit us a great deal. So in terms of what we saw, I think you might have noticed also that it wasn't just agriculture that performed in the entire year that performed well. We also had we saw finance coming in strongly, not just on the annual basis, but also on the quarterly basis. But that is, we know that finance is the biggest or largest industry in the country. But what is of concern could be perhaps that given the high unemployment rate that we have in the country, finance is not anywhere close to absorbing the masses of unemployed, and that's our reality. So if it is that we've got, those industries that are leading, that are growing, but that are not necessarily inclined to job creation, that is a bit of a concern in the long run.
Let me pivot to manufacturing, if I can. It is once again contracted, and that is a big warning sign, surely, for jobs and exports.
Definitely, definitely, because we rely largely on manufacturing for not just local consumption, but also for exports, as you've correctly said it. But, okay, so the point to be made is that if we're not able to produce or manufacture, it is a problem because it means we cannot meet the existing demand locally and abroad. And because there's also a need for us to start thinking about how to tap into external markets, markets within Africa or globally. If we cannot manufacture or produce, that becomes a big problem. And having talked about job creation, we know that manufacturing has got potential to absorb the masses of the unskilled, the low-skilled, and the like. So if it's not producing and if it's not doing well, then that's a sign for catastrophe going forward. So yeah, it is very important for us to keep an eye on what is happening there. I think we have also noted that the contraction was just not in the short-term view, in the quarter, but it was also on an annual basis. So that is a bit of a concern.
And all of that, of course, is contingent on companies expanding capacity, which they're not doing. The Stats SA numbers also point to falling investment. And that says a lot, surely, about confidence in the economy.
Exactly. So investment is the basis for sustainable growth. And perhaps that I should just say it is an indicator for business sentiment. So if it is that we are seeing a contraction in gross fixed capital formation, that's cause for concern because it simply says people are not going to be trusting enough, to invest in South Africa. And that's a problem. Without investment, unfortunately, the growth for the country, economic growth, cannot have a solid base. So it is worrying. It is a concern that we, in the long run or the long-term view of our numbers, show a contraction in investment. However, that being the long-term story, it is comforting to see that there's a bit of an improvement if you look at things quarter to quarter. You might recall, Jeremy, that we've had a number of quarters where we saw a contraction in investments. However, in the third quarter, we have seen two consecutive improvements, positive growth rates, and that's something for us to celebrate. Yes, it's not sustainable. We don't know how long this is going to be the case, but if it is that we have consistently growing investments and gross fixed capital formation, that's definitely a bonus for us. So we can hope that perhaps going forward, that trend will be maintained and perhaps start turning things around for us, from the point of view of the long term, because without certainty as to what is going to happen and without long-term investments in the country, we definitely are going to have a problem.
Dr. Bogang Vumbukani Lepolesa is the Chief Director of National Accounts at Statistics South Africa. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might have heard that Volkswagen South Africa has announced a recall of certain Polo Vivo models, and it's raising, I think, fresh questions about vehicle safety, but also more worryingly, the growing number of recalls. Now, as I understand it, while recalls are meant to fix problems before they become dangerous, they would also, I imagine, place real pressure not only on people on the front line, in other words, dealership staff who must deal directly with frustrated customers, but even technicians in the workshop. So let's look at this angle to the story. And I'm in conversation now with Pakamile Hlubi Majola from the Motor Industry Staff Association. It's a body that represents workers across the retail sector. Pakamile, welcome. And let me start with the basics, maybe. From the perspective of dealership staff, how serious is this Polo Vivo recall? And what are people being told about the issue?
So it is a very serious issue. The fact that you've got 25, close to 26,000 cars that have been recalled, and the reasons that have been given by VW being that there seems to be a problem with the handbrake, that is very, very serious. And of course, you can imagine this is what our members are reporting, is really around the frustration of consumers on this issue, having to bring the car in. And for many, and also the fact that, you know, people would obviously want detail around what's going on, what the problems would be. And if the staff is unable to answer some of those questions to the satisfaction of the customers, then of course tensions will rise. So really that's where what the feedback we're getting. But for us as an organization, we are deeply concerned about the numbers. I mean, if you tie this to the AAA's report that was issued, where it speaks about 50,000 recalls just in 2025, it does, you know, make one very concerned about the state of the quality of some of these vehicles.
Let's talk a little about that frustration that you reference. Often those working in dealerships become the first line, often of antagonism, as far as customers are concerned. Pakamile, what does that look like in practice when a recall like this happens? How does it unfold?
Well, my understanding is that essentially you would have received a message from most likely the dealership with regards to the fact that your particular vehicle has been affected. Please bring it in so that a test can then be run with regards to try and establish what the problem is, or if there is a problem, and how it can be repaired. And I think ultimately, you know, from the perspective of MISA, in terms of what our members have or what they experience, it's really more around, as I said, where people would want a greater assurance that these vehicles are safe. And I think if you tie that to particularly some of the questions that have been raised in this report that talks about the fact that there's not as much focus as there should be when it comes to quality assurance, particularly before the vehicles make it out onto the dealership floor, that's where the problem is. And of course, people also will have a tendency to make accusations that the dealership or the sales staff are the ones who sold them a defective vehicle. So all of those things are things that sort of compound the situation. And this is what prompted us to raise this issue on a public platform.
It's interesting because often the people that you're talking about end up then carrying the reputational burden for problems that actually, if I am hearing you correctly, originate at manufacturing level.
Absolutely. And that is what we are trying to highlight, because ultimately we are a union that focuses on worker issues. This for us would be of concern because this is the type of feedback we're getting. But also at the same time, we're very concerned about the sector as a whole. We think that these issues regarding the recalls are forcing the industry to have a very serious conversation about looking at what are the norms and standards, and whether or not they need to take stronger measures to maintain quality, because they're not going to benefit from this type of situation if it continues at the rate at which it continues. And I think we also need to be clear, I don't want to isolate VW. It happens to be VW now. Last year, there were other vehicle brands that were also affected by serious numbers of recall. And that's what sparked the report. put by the AA to really raise this issue and bring it to the fore. And for us as MISA, the issue of safety is something that we take very seriously. Safety of workers, but also safety of the public. So we think that this is a serious enough matter, now that we've had another recall where high numbers of cars are being brought in, that the industry has to really look at this matter and take decisive steps to increase quality and quality control before the cars make it out onto the market.
And when your organization raises this issue with the auto manufacturers, what kind of response do you get?
Our position as MISA is that, first of all, we organize primarily in the retail motor industry. So we are not dealing with the auto manufacturers. But because we're dealing in the retail motor, we organize in the retail motor industry, we are at the point at which these vehicles are then sold to the consumer. So we are the front line that engages directly with the public. And that is why it's important for us to raise this, because we experience it firsthand in terms of the response from the public in relation to these recalls. And so we are raising it from that perspective to say that it is of benefit to all of us who operate in this space. If you're talking from the value chain at manufacturing all the way to the point where we're dealing with the dealership floor, it is in our interest to make sure that we raise these issues so that we ensure that quality and standards are maintained. This is a volatile sector that is, unfortunately, it can respond negatively to things like high fuel prices, which unfortunately we might be facing now as a result of the war in Iran, along with other matters like, for example, the strength of the dollar. So when it comes to issues of safety as well, the industry has a responsibility to take steps to make sure that we regulate this, to make sure that where there are problems, we nip it in the bud, because it's going to affect everybody and we all need to benefit. And the only way we can do that is if we maintain basic things like safety and standards.
By regulation, you'd be suggesting then that maybe there should be clearer rules on how manufacturers communicate recalls so dealership workers are not left to manage that public anger that you're referring to.
That would definitely be among the recommendations we would make, because, you know, for example, if we use this example of this situation, we think it would perhaps assist if there was more regular communication. Now that the announcement was made that a vehicle recalls are taking place, I think it would also be helpful if there was more stronger communication, perhaps regarding how the problem is being resolved, how many cars have been taken in, etc. I think just communication to assure the public, and not just assurances, though, Jeremy, but also steps being taken to make sure that we don't have these types of problems. Among the things that the AA raises, if you read the report, is they talk about the fact that the problems are not being picked up at the earliest point before the cars get sold to the market, saying that a lot of the problems are actually being picked up through diagnostics after it's been sold. So that means that definitely steps can be taken perhaps at that level to try and improve those standards so that we can limit these incidents. And also because at the end of the day, it does pose real safety threats. This particular matter involving the handbrake, I mean, imagine what could happen when you're on a steep hill and the handbrake fails to operate. So this is why we're raising these types of issues as MISA, to say we really need to take seriously what is emerging around problems that are coming out as a result of vehicle recalls.
I'm going to leave it there. Phakamile Hlubi-Majola from the Motor Industry Staff Association, MISA, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's budget is under fire from environmental activists who say it risks locking the country into a fossil fuel future at precisely the moment the world is shifting towards greener energy. Now, critics argue that while government talks about a just energy transition, the budget offers little clarity on funding, timelines or implementation while still supporting coal-heavy infrastructure and energy subsidies. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm joined now by Lisa Makaula, who's advocacy lead at the Green Connection. It's a sustainable development advocacy group. Lisa, a very warm welcome. Let's start with your central claim. Why do you say that the budget risks locking us in to a fossil fuel future? What's your argument?
I mean, we are not rejecting the budget. I mean, for short-term relief, it does sound like a good position, particularly for the fiscal strategy. But we're a bit worried about the long-term strategies in terms of basically addressing the energy crisis in the country. And this basically speaks to industrialization and the emerging new economies, basically of renewable energy, which are becoming much more cheaper. And basically in this budget, this wasn't spoken too much about, but it was just highlighted that there would be investments basically for our energy infrastructure. But it was not basically discussed in terms of how the money that South Africa is getting from the Just Energy Transition Partnerships will basically make sure that we are transitioning from our fossil fuel industries to the renewable energy industries.
So if it was short on detail, is your argument then that it's giving a lie to the government's argument that it is actively pursuing a just energy transition?
We wouldn't say it's giving a lie, but I think if it would have been detailed enough to just highlight in terms of the money that South Africa is getting from the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, what it would do in terms of mitigating risks of climate change, but also in terms of mitigating risks of energy poverty. And I think this would speak to the current, basically, crisis, because currently electricity is expensive. But there are other scenarios whereby, you know, renewable energy is becoming much more cheaper, as well as battery storage. So those weren't really highlighted as much as we would have liked to see, as well as how the current how the workers that are currently employed in the fossil fuel industry would also be funded to transition to these emerging new economies.
Lisa, we know that South Africa has secured billions in international climate finance. So the funding is there, but the sense is the implementation isn't clear. What risks then do you think that creates for the transition itself?
I mean, it risks leaving out the poor, vulnerable communities behind. And I think this would basically speak to the communities that are based in Limpopo and Mpumalanga. You know, the people there are basically suffering, especially from respiratory diseases. And we cannot be having debates whether we are transitioning or not. We should be really looking into how we are going to move forward with this transition, but also making sure that we are careful about it. We are not just switching up, but we are moving in a fair and equitable manner whereby these communities that are most affected, they are involved in this transition, but also the workers, because we've got people that are working in these industries and, you know, they play a very important role in our economy. So we definitely need a plan of how this money would be implemented, from skilling people, upskilling people, making sure that they've got the relevant skills to fit in the current emerging industries. But also we have enough understanding of how adaptation and risk mitigation measures would be implemented for climate change.
And you make a very important point, but on the flip side of your argument, there are also a lot of people working within the fossil fuel industry, and you've raised concerns about continued subsidy in that particular respect. It's all about finding the balance at this point, surely.
Yes, definitely.
So how do you do
that? If I mean, that's why we are saying that if these are not discussions that are brought forward, basically to showcase how the people that are currently employed in the fossil fuel industry would be upskilled to transition to the renewable industry, then it risks it deepening inequality in the communities. Then that means without a plan, then only a certain group, you know, would be able to fit in those industry. But if we have a plan whereby the people that are currently employed in the coal industry, in the fossil fuel industry, get upskilled, they get enough resources so that they would be able to fit in the current emerging industries of new renewable energy technology, which is becoming much more cheaper, then that helps our youth to be able to engage in the current emerging economies. But also it kind of caps our employment crisis that we have.
It's an interesting one, because government says it's got to balance energy security and economic growth alongside climate goals. It's not realistic, though, for South Africa to move faster away from coal without impacting jobs and also perhaps risking power shortages.
Definitely. That's why I was saying earlier on, we can't just switch up and decide that tomorrow we are moving to the renewable energy industry. It needs to be a process that is fair and equitable. And with that process, that means we need to put these processes in our strategies, because in this fiscal strategy, it was not clearly outlined in terms of how the money that South Africa is receiving from international donors would actually facilitate that transition. The transition takes time, and obviously it can't happen within a day. It means that you need to consider the value chains, you need to consider the economy, you need to consider also the skills that are required.
So if government were to change course then, and this is a last question to you, what would you like to see in the next budget to make the transition genuinely just?
It would be great to hear how South Africa, the money that is receiving, would actually speak to the needs of the people and in the communities. And I think this also comes to some of the declarations that were done in G20, basically fast-tracking our renewable energy solutions and sustainable energy solutions and making sure that there's beneficiation within communities. So I think making sure that those strategies and deliberations in terms of finance that is coming to South Africa is showcased in this fiscal strategy, then it would show us that this is something that the government actually wants to make sure that it prioritizes the marginalized communities that have not benefited before, and also to make sure that no one is left behind.
That's where I'm going to leave it. Lisa Makula, thank you very much indeed. Advocacy lead at the Green Connection.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's retirement system is undergoing, I'm told, one of its biggest shifts in decades, and the consequences could shape how millions of South Africans save, spend, and ultimately retire, I guess. A new survey by PwC suggests the two-pot retirement system, governance reforms, and also rising cyber risks, they're always there, aren't they, are fundamentally changing how retirement funds operate. So let's bring into the conversation Karen Drummond, Associate Director, Retirement Funds at PwC. Karen, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe a start with a big picture if we can. How dramatically is the retirement landscape changing right now? What's the assessment here?
Hi, Jeremy. Yes, thanks very much for inviting us to chat to you about our survey. Yes, I think the two-pot system, when it came in 2024, was the biggest thing impacting funds. It changed the way members are looking at what their benefits are, when they can have access to their benefits. And the other thing that's also big on everybody's mind at the moment, especially the trustees, maybe not so much the members themselves, but a concern for the trustees, as you said, is the cyber. And I think it links to that, the conduct standard that came out from the FSCA, and it's really highlighted the responsibilities of the board of looking after the funds and their members.
Karen, most of us will understand this through the two-pot retirement system. Now, if I remember correctly, it was meant to give people emergency access to savings. As a result of that, have we seen dramatic changes in how people behave financially?
Yes, we are. For the funds, there was a big withdrawal of members, or members wanting to take money out of their retirement funds when it first got implemented. Yes, that first amount that they could have access to was limited to, I think, 30,000 Rand that they were able to access. But we can see each tax year, they are allowed to take a new withdrawal out of their savings pot. And we are seeing at the start of each tax year, we are seeing more and more members coming in to make that savings claim. Where previously members didn't have access to these funds in the past unless they left their employer, and now they are able to access this retirement money.
So Karen, the survey shows many withdrawals come from people aged between 30 and 40, but what I would find concerning is that younger members are now withdrawing money as well, at surely the stage in their life where they should be saving as much as possible. How damaging is that likely to be to long-term retirement outcome?
Yes, so it is concerning, and I think it's also that is also where the fund education and the trustees bringing in communication and education with the members becomes so important, because you're very right, very correct. The members need to save as much as they can when they're younger so they've got that money for when they retire. I think if you have a look at the acts that are applicable to retirement, members have always been allowed to take up to one third of their money in cash when they're retired. So I think that one third principle hasn't changed too much. It's about when they are allowed to access that money. And the fact that members are now able to access that money whenever they can, it can have an impact on members, how much they're expecting to get when they retire. And we have seen that come through in the survey as well, is that the trustees do see how important that member education and that member communication is becoming.
On the positive side, though, again, if I've read this correctly, less than 10% of members access their savings in the early phase of the system. That is reassuring, but given the geopolitical situation that we find ourselves in right now and the cost of living squeeze, inevitably that usage is likely to rise over time. That, again, is worrying, isn't it?
Yes. So if you have a look at our survey, so from the participants who took part, they did say that in their cases, less than 10% of their members actually came and took withdrawals from their savings pots. I think there was a lot more. If you look at what was happening in industry, in the newspaper, it seemed that it was a lot more that was coming through. But I think as members contribute and as their savings pots become bigger, they might have more incentive to want to take a little bit of money out of there. But like I say, that member education is where the trustees can play their part to make a difference.
Let's move away from savings in the two pot. Your survey also says that retirement funds themselves are also evolving, and by all accounts for the better. The suggestion is boards are becoming more professionalized and better remunerated. What impact does that have on a consumer then?
I think very important. The board members are, half of them at least, are appointed by the members of the fund, and they are the ones making the decisions for the members. And if they make the right decisions, it will benefit the members when they do retire. So yes, we do see the boards becoming more professional, meeting on a regular basis. I think the funds are seeing that trustees need to get paid for the skills and the time that they're putting into the funds to make these important decisions. And that is what we've seen in the survey as well.
On the flip side, though, some critics might say that rising trustee fees would just add costs for members. Is it difficult for funds to justify the changes in remuneration, do you think?
Look, the trustees play a very, very important role. So I think this survey is one of the ways that the funds can see whether what they're paying their trustees are in line with what's happening in the industry. But yes, it's a balance that they need to make. The trustees need to be fairly remunerated. They are putting in a lot of time, a lot of skills to make those decisions for the funds. But also, like you say, there is the flip side. The fund is responsible for paying that remuneration, and anything that the fund is paying, it's taking away from the fund.
And just a quick reflection as we pivot back to cybersecurity. It's a growing risk for retirement funds. I get that. Why, though, has this become a sudden priority, do you think? What has changed?
So the FSCA issued a joint standard on cybersecurity, and it really changed the way that funds need to assess the cyber risks that they are possibly exposed to. And one of the main things coming out of that was looking at what risks, or how do their service providers manage those risks? So it wasn't just looking at the fund itself, but also looking at all the service providers to the fund, how they manage their risks. And the trustees need to be comfortable that they have obtained enough information from those service providers to satisfy themselves that those risks are being appropriately managed.
I mean, that applies to all sectors, doesn't it? Karen Drummond, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate the conversation. Associate Director, Retirement Funds at PwC. And that's our program for today. You have been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.